Welcome back to the Medieval Irish History Podcast. Thanks to all of our guests in the series so far. As we've said before, this podcast isn't for profit, so it really wouldn't work without our excellent guests who give freely of their time and expertise. And we've been very grateful, especially to people like our guest today, Dr. Alva Johnston, who've been able to come the whole way out to Maynooth to the recording studio here. The facilities kindly provided by the music department and Maynooth University. Okay, now what we're doing today is the start of what I've only just decided in the last few days is kind of like a little trilogy on kind of Ireland before the 7th century, a kind of Ireland in kind of late antiquity and the earliest written sources. So as I said, we're starting today with Dr. Alva Johnston, who's a medieval historian, and then we'll have a podcast in 2 weeks' time on St. Patrick from an archaeologist, and then we're going to have a third episode straight after that on the Ulm writing system and the early Irish language with linguist Professor David Stifter. So yeah, I'm hoping this kind of little trilogy will work out well, and at the end of it we'll have a really kind of good idea of what Ireland was like, as I said, kind of before the 7th century, which is when we start to get lots and lots of written sources. Now, I had initially pitched this episode as "How often do you think about the Roman Empire?" to piggyback on the TikTok trend that started at the end of last summer and in early autumn, as I suspect that every historian of early Ireland, like myself and Alva, probably think about the Roman Empire every day. I don't know, Elva's laughing at me. No. Now, we're so far past this trend now. Like, it was literally last year, so it's not really relevant anymore. But the Roman Empire will crop up a lot today and probably over the next couple of episodes as well. So let me introduce my excellent guest today. So Dr. Alva Johnston is an associate professor in the School of History in University College Dublin. She's another medievalist who specialises in way too many subjects to name, but she puts loads of her work up on academia.edu. So if you can get on that, do please. She has a great article out at the moment on St. Bridget, which I give full details in the notes for in the St. Bridget podcast episode. She also has an award-winning book on literacy and identity in early medieval Ireland, published with Boyd Allen Brewer from 2013. But most importantly for today's episode, she wrote two important articles. I'll put details in the episode notes, a few years ago on Ireland kind of as a forgotten frontier in late antiquity, which kind of situated Ireland firmly within the wider Roman world and looking at kind of definitions of kind of Ireland in the conversion period and this kind of thing. Okay, so traditionally Ireland was either ignored, Alva has shown, in general discourses about the period, or seen as unique and at odds with developments in other parts of what we kind of now call Europe more generally. And as we've seen in many episodes of the podcast so far, situation in Ireland, as everywhere else, was a lot more complex and nuanced than that. So welcome, Alva, and thanks for coming the whole way out to Maynooth.
Not that it was very far.
From Dublin.
I mean, Dublin is pretty close. So it would be pretty pathetic if I couldn't, you know, make it that distance.
Well, we do appreciate it. Thank you. So let's kind of, we start off with kind of some big, broad stuff. Was Ireland ever part of the Roman Empire?
Well, Ireland wasn't politically part of the Roman Empire. But on the other hand, it wasn't apart from the Roman Empire.
Okay.
And I like to make that distinction, that it's not part of, but it's not apart. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways it's worth thinking about it is Ireland, OK, is not politically within that system, but at the same time, it's connected to trade, economics and politics in various ways. In some ways, you could look at it as the way the UK post-Brexit is still linked into that European system of trade and communication, but sees itself as politically apart. So Ireland is quite connected into the rest of the Roman world. You know, it's relatively peripheral from the Roman point of view. It's worth remembering that the Roman Empire is a Mediterranean empire, and that the Atlantic regions of the Roman Empire, while they're being more examined now by scholars, and there's a great study coming out in the next year from OUP looking at the Roman Atlantic.
Oh, cool.
In comparison and contrast with the Roman Mediterranean. It's still relatively peripheral to the Romans, but it's not peripheral to the Irish.
Yeah, exactly. And so do we have kind of evidence of like trade and travel and stuff?
We've loads of evidence of trade. So a lot of the evidence we have is, as you might expect, it's archaeological. Mm. And some of the most important, I suppose, contributions, particularly since I suppose as early as the 1970s have come from archaeology, and it is yet another example of how people working on material culture and on text should communicate with each other more than they do. Yeah. And it's particularly important when we're looking at the early centuries of Irish history. So just to give you a flavour of the types of material that we find, we know from the objects that there's a fair amount of trade between the first and second centuries of the Common Era. There's a bit of a break in the third century, but that's found pretty much everywhere. It's a bit of a mystery for people working on the Roman Empire. And then in the fourth and fifth century, you see that pattern of trade turning into piracy. And hence you get St. Patrick and the rest of it.
Okay.
But in terms of trade, what we're looking at is trade in consumables. Mm. So the Irish are importing olive oil, wine, probably fish sauce, garum, which is a Roman delicacy, which would probably turn our stomachs nowadays. And I'm not sure how good the wine would have been either after that length of time in transport. The reason we know it's this type of trade is because of the amphorae that are found. So they're pottery shards that are found, often reused by the Irish as well. And one of the reasons we know they're not from Ireland is because Irish society is aceramic. And there isn't a native pottery during this period. So all the pottery we find is actually imported. So you've got pottery. Mm. You also have things like toiletry objects. Yeah. So, I mean, my personal favourite are ear picks that are used to clear wax out of your ear. But imagine instead of a sort of a Q-tip or a cotton bud that you have a metal spoon that you're shoving into your ear.
And so, that they imported this.
And they're importing them. So, I mean, there's something going on with status and how elites are identifying themselves. One of the best examples of this.
They like their fancy stuff.
They like their fancy stuff. They like their wine. And look, the Irish word for wine, fionn, is a borrowing from Latin.
Yeah.
You know, so it's an important early loan word that's coming from that trade. They're also adopting things like brooch types. Okay. So if you think about Irish brooch types, I guess a lot of people would think of maybe the Tara brooch, those big pseudo-penannular brooches, but they're ultimately derived from Roman military, Romano-British ring brooches. And so it's an example of how the Irish elites emulate various types of Roman costume, as well as importing objects. So we can see from all of that, that there is that connection.
Yeah.
And then they're also on top of this. And I think this is, I suppose, from a historical point of view, is almost the most fascinating, is there's a political dimension to this as well. So again, just to give you a few snapshots, Tacitus, who's writing towards the end of the first century of the Common Era, he writes a sort of a biography of his father-in-law, Agricola, who's a governor in Britain. And Agricola becomes governor after there had been a major contest around Roman authority on the island of Britain. And he's very interested in the frontiers and in protecting Roman power within the island. And it contains a reference to Ireland. So Tacitus tells us that the ports are well known from the traders. But he also mentions that there's a minor king who he describes as a Regulus, a sort of a petty king, who basically rocks up to Agricola. And he's been cast away from Ireland. He's basically an early version of Dermot MacMurrough.
Yeah.
And he seems to be sort of suggesting that maybe the Romans would come. But Agricola, in the end, Agricola goes, yeah, I think we could conquer Ireland easily. But he ultimately, they don't.
Yeah.
So there's that level of political engagement. What languages are they using to communicate? Is there a knowledge of Latin? Are they using forms of British Celtic? I mean, there's a lot of questions there. And then when we fast forward to the fourth century, the Roman historian Ammianus, in his Res Gestae, refers to the barbarian conspiracy in which the Irish, who, you know, the Scots, means the same thing during this period, more or less, the Picts and the Saxons break previous agreements. Yeah. So again, and it's assuming
a level of diplomacy,
and it's something that Ammianus talks about in other parts of his work. So, for example, Roman client kings are often paid off in objects of status. So in, you know, fibulae, pins, ornamentation. And given that Ireland is a non-coin economy, that would be part of it. By the way, though, even though it's a non-coin economy, by far the most common Roman objects in Ireland are coins.
Are coins.
There's a lot of coins. I mean, particularly the big hoard, yeah. say, late 4th, early 5th century hoard from Coleraine. Mm. But there's quite a lot of other coin finds as well. So
do you think then they were using those coins, you know, like trading them or treating
using
them as a whole item? Like, would the hoards have stayed together?
So I think in some cases, like in Coleraine, they stayed together, but in others, and there's a, if people are interested, there's a great article by Colleen O'Driscoll called Roman Kilkenny.
Okay,
it's one
of my
favorite titles for an article of all time.
I haven't
basically
read that one.
But one of the things that he shows is that they're using the coins as objects of display as well.
Okay.
So they're using them as sort of elite objects.
Yeah.
So
and there's a couple of coins at Newgrange, wasn't
there's
there?
A few coins at Newgrange. I mean, obviously, as you know, the problem with Newgrange is that the sequence, the stratigraphy isn't very clear because of the sort of horrendous digs that happened in the 19th century. But there's loads of evidence. Now, within that evidence, what we're beginning to see more clearly is, yes, there is an East Coast bias, as you would expect. So the main trade, Roman trade, some of it may be coming directly from Iberia, but others probably coming from Britain.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of it is in the East Coast, but there does seem to be important redistribution centres. Where Kilkenny is now is probably one of them, you know, in that sort of North Shore Barrow region. It seems to be quite important as well. So, you know, there's definitely a disparity in the evidence, but it shows that there's a sort of an East Coast, almost an East Coast province of Roman influence, I would say. Now, obviously, the breaking news that will be coming on this will be when we get the full results of the dig at Dromana.
Yeah.
You know, not very far from here either. You know, and that'll absolutely give us a sense of whether we're looking at intermittent trading or are we looking at trading that's existing consistently over a long period of time. So one of the questions we have around Dromana, it's like in North County Dublin, is whether we're looking at an established trading site and a trading site that lasted over multiple generations.
And do we know the initial dates that are coming
I've been reading up about it lately. So the question is whether it's something that will span that first, second century, third, you know, and then the fourth, fifth century things. Fourth, fifth century, you're getting probably more materials of a particular type. So the great big coin hoard in Coleraine. But that's probably pointing, I would say, to a difference in the relationship, which we also see in the writings of Patrick and in Ammianus's reference to the barbarian conspiracy. Yeah. So what we're looking at is maybe those trade networks become sort of networks of piracy, you know, particularly as Roman power in Britain declines. And the two are always very closely connected.
Okay, you've brought it up now, actually. So let's go in there. There's about five questions I kind of wanted to follow up on there, but you've said about the Roman Britain declining. So, okay, there's a couple of things. One, I want to talk a bit about periodization, and that's something that I struggle with constantly as a historian, and especially teaching history. Because I think when you're writing about your own research, it's okay, like all the nuances and you're getting into so much detail and stuff. But when you're trying to, you know, like teach undergraduates, whatever, dates and periods are handy, you know, for historians. But there can be kind of arbitrary and, you know, very kind of linear and binary and all that kind of thing. But on the one hand, one thing I wanted to say was kind of we take history and kind of Irish history or the discipline of history as the study of written documents and written sources. But of course, any Irish medieval historian anyway, any good one, you're going to, as you just already showed us, you know, you need to use all the evidence available to you. As you've just shown us, archaeological, linguistic, everything. But really, you know, your bread and butter is in the written sources. And the earliest written sources we have from Ireland that survive are Patrick's writings.
I would add into that the Ogham Stones.
Okay, and the Ogham Stones, exactly.
Yeah,
okay,
because they do preserve texts as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And they do actually tell us a lot about history, But you know, this whole thing about, so the you're saying the decline of Roman Britain, if we're talking about we say early medieval Ireland, you know, kind of starting almost with kind of St. Patrick in a way, but is he very much an individual representing this kind of time? You know, is he a late, is he an example of a, you know, he's a Roman, a citizen of late Roman Britain, you know, and this is kind of, he's from this time of the disintegration of the Roman Empire. You know, is it right to even talk about the, how do we talk about the end of the Roman Empire as a defining period in Irish history? And even what is late antiquity?
Yeah, I think there are two, there's two very good questions there. You know what, I'll start with the Roman Empire because it's really directly related to the late antiquity question. So it used to be, you know this yourself, Niamh, it was used to be common enough in textbooks to say the Roman Empire ends in the West in 476 with the deposition of Romulus Augustulus. And of course, it's sort of a nice one because you have a Romulus founding Rome and then a Romulus as the last Western Empire emperor. But, you know, that's just not true. And most scholars would now say that it would not have been apparent to anybody in 476 that the Roman Empire had come to an end. It's sort of, as somebody put it, it sort of faded away. And in a way, you get various successors to the Roman Empire still trying to claim that. So, you know, you get obviously Charlemagne later with the Holy Roman Empire. But even if you look at somebody like Clovis and the Franks taking a title like consul, taking this very Romanized title, and the Eastern Empire continues to flourish you know, for sort of another
topic for another day.
For another 1,000 years. So, I mean, this idea that the Roman Empire falls is, it's convenient, but it's not really true. And so that's really problematic. So that then throws into chaos the whole periodization. So if you go Roman Empire falls in 476 and we now go, well, no, that's just not the way it works. It's then, that's the end of antiquity. And then you have the beginning of the early Middle Ages. So it's based on effectively the misreading of a single date.
Yeah.
And nowadays, it really sort of, I suppose scholars have really begun to say there's Roman and then it's what they would sort of call sub-Roman.
Okay.
So there's that continuation of Roman norms, obviously the survival of Latin as a major language of speech to this day, through all of the Romance languages. So all of that's in the mix. And late antiquity has sort of emerged as a term to cover that period of transition from the late Roman period, when you still have, say, in the 4th century, a functional, very powerful Western Roman Empire, to maybe the beginning of the 7th century. And it's a period in which the idea of being Roman or what Roman is still very important to people like Patrick, who you mentioned. You know, because it's unclear whether Patrick is living in a Roman or a sub-Roman Britain. And to him, that would have been a meaningless question, because it was it was Roman to him.
He wouldn't have seen it.
So he wouldn't have seen it. He wouldn't have used the arbitrary dates. Like, he wouldn't have said, oh, the Romans left Britain in 412. I'm no longer a Roman. So that sort of arbitrariness wouldn't have been how contemporaries see it. So I think it's very useful from that point of view for really questioning and bringing that nuance into the periodization. I think there's another really important thing that talking about late antiquity does is it also makes it really clear that we're not just talking about Europe. So late antiquity can be seen, I mean, yes, there's a sort of a geographical element to it as well, but it's that Mediterranean world. And if you're thinking about the centres of late antiquity, you're thinking of North Africa, you're thinking of the Persian Empire, you're thinking of Arabia, thinking of the Roman Empire, and you're also thinking of Europe as well. While I think more problematically, the early Middle Ages were very much the European early Middle Ages. So with scholars of late antiquity, and it's a term that I suppose has gained prominence with the work of Peter Brown from the 1970s, with late antiquity, you're in a way encouraged into a comparative framework where you're thinking about that Mediterranean culture, how it's expressed, how it changes as it travels away from its Mediterranean heartlands, how that changes with the politics, and then how that leads the way towards what we would see in I suppose, later in the early Middle Ages.
Yeah, and so I mentioned an article, well, a couple of articles, but one in particular in the introduction. What I think you've, what one of the things you've done, which is really important to me in understanding this whole period, is placing Ireland very much within that world. So, you know, when does kind of medieval history start in Ireland? Would you agree with the kind of, like, we broadly kind of say, we talk about like 500 to 1500, this kind of like general 1,000 years of the Middle Ages in Europe? Or like, you know, where does Ireland come within that?
Yeah, I always find that's, yeah, again, I mean,
it's just,
you know,
a nice, it's a nice 1,000, 5 to 15.
Exactly. Yeah. And in teaching, you probably would know, yeah, that there's sometimes an assumption that if you're working on material in 500, you can do that 1500 stuff as well. At which point I would sort of run screaming normally.
Well, I don't go past. Now I'm up to like the 12th century. But usually I don't go past.
I keep it to
1014.
I keep it to three figures as much as I possibly can. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, what I would say now, and I suppose it's an evolution in my own scholarship. Mm. And if we were having this conversation 10 years ago, I don't think I would have said what I'm going to say now. Mm. So I would see, you mentioned the 7th century when we get a lot more material coming in. I would almost see that,
okay,
as that's your early middle
age. Yeah.
And before that, what you're looking, yeah, at is the unwinding of late antiquity, yeah, in Ireland, as you are elsewhere. It's been difficult, I think, for non-Irish scholars in particular to see that, because the language we use is not the language they use. So we talk about, say, the later Iron Age, mm, but we periodize the Iron Age differently, as far as I understand.
Mm. We, and then have, we feed straight from that
into early medieval. So we tend to go from Patrick, and we do this big jump, mm, over probably one of the most interesting periods in Irish history.
In the sixth century,
yeah, because that's when the church becomes bedded, yeah, down as an institution.
Yeah.
And you don't have the culture that emerges in the 7th century. The other reason I think the 7th century is, because at the moment I'm working on a project, and the debate I had about it was whether I would finish in 650, mm, or 600. Now, very arbitrary dates, but I realised that if I moved too far into the 7th century, the amount of material would overwhelm,
you see,
everything,
yeah,
else.
In.
And in the 7th century, one of the really interesting things they're doing, those authors, is they're actually thinking about their own past.
Yeah.
And they're creating those frameworks of understanding that make it resonate for them.
Yeah.
And those frameworks, while much of the content has been rejected, I'm thinking, for example, of Binchy's famous article, St. Patrick and his, mm, biographers. Mm. So while much of that content has been rejected, the basic format they use has not been. So,
yeah,
you know, we've continued in that type of format of, yeah, Irish history begins with St. Patrick. Oh, and then we have the church in the 7th century.
Yeah, I know. And then we kind of, well, the archaeology is telling us a good bit now about the 6th century. But
it is. And again, this is an example where I think more fruitful,
yeah, we,
conversations,
yeah,
can,
yeah,
can happen.
And actively, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I would certainly say, in terms of my understanding of how things are happening, a lot of it is coming from what's been, yeah, said about the material context, but also comparatively, because,
yeah,
there's such a great literature in late antiquity as well, because what you're in effect getting are people moving forward from the classical era and moving, mm, backwards from the early Middle Ages.
And they're meeting
in late antiquity. So it's fascinating.
Kind of the other thing that you kind of do in these, that we're kind of delving into basically in this episode today, is first of all understanding Ireland as part of this kind of wider world and what's going on in late antiquity, but also in how this period in Ireland has just been traditionally framed in religious terms, you know, and in conversion terms and in Christianity terms, which when I say it out loud now sounds a little odd, like how you would ever frame, you know, stuff that went on, you know, history, just in terms of, you know, what belief system someone had, or even what religious, you know, church or anything. But can you talk a little bit about that? How, yeah, that's it's traditionally like, so we don't say, we used to say, like Thomas Charles Edwards, you know, great historians of early Ireland, his very famous book, Early Christian Ireland, which I still recommend, is a brilliant book. But you can't say early Christian Ireland anymore, because that's defining this period in religious terms, which it shouldn't be.
No, it's very confusing, because one of the things it does, my poor second years, their first lecture starts with, we can't use early Christian.
Or pagan, or Celtic.
Or Celtic. Let's just go with those chronological frameworks that we've been disparaging. So, but yeah, so I think that the problem with using the term early Christian, it's exactly what you said, Niamh, is that I suppose it's presupposing a number of things. It's presupposing that the main identity of the society and all aspects of it is articulated through religious belief. And that's clearly not true. It's not true of any society. You know, if you think about the work that's been done on group affiliations and identities, you know, particularly, I suppose, in anthropology and sociology, one of the things that's been shown again and again is that people have multiple identities that they deploy at different times in their lives or during their days. And we do it all the time ourselves. So people don't have these very monolithic hegemonistic identities. So I think that's problematic, because it's assuming something about the society which isn't true and takes away from the complexity of what that society is about. I can see where it comes from, in the sense that the articulation of Irish culture in a way by Christian writers is very important. But I think you can do it in a much better way. So Kathleen Hughes calls her great book The Church in Early Irish Society. And that's actually a much better way of framing it is, OK, here's the church. It's really important. It's an institution. But, you know, if you think about somebody like, say, Diarmaid MacCarroll, you know, King of Tara, probably the last person to celebrate the Feast of Tara. He's a Christian, but he's also a king. And he's multiple identities that he expresses at different times. So I think it's very problematic, and it means that we ask very particular questions, and we end up, as you said, we end up with this very binary view of Irish society. And, you know, in a sense, if you say it's early Christian, you might as well say it's late pagan. You know, that sort of binary opposition, I think, isn't helpful in terms of trying to understand how that culture operates or how it sees itself.
So I want to get on to, in a minute, the question of whether the church revolutionized Irish society, and whether we have any clue as to what society would have was like before you know, the church, the kind of the Roman church, was firmly established and sophisticated in Ireland, which we know it was by the seventh century at the latest. But if we kind of go back to kind of exploring that whole late antique period, and like the role of Patrick as kind of like our symbol, you know, of everything that was going on, like, we know that Patrick didn't introduce Christianity to Ireland, and we won't talk about him too much, because we're going to be talking about him in 2 weeks
and probably
time,
a lot of detail as well.
Okay, so. But we know that there were Christians, and so can we talk about kind of the, not without talking about Patrick, kind of what the your introduction of Christianity was?
Absolutely. And I mean, I suppose the first thing I would say is the first Christians in Ireland are people whose names we don't know. So, you know, you'll get endless debates about, is Patrick first or is Palladius first? But what they're first at is not introducing Christianity. It's establishing some sort of institution. So establishing the church as an institution, which becomes very successful, as we know, is not identical to people becoming Christian. So in the famous narrative in Murrachu, which is of course an invention, where Patrick lights the first Easter fire on the hill of Slane, you know, it's just some randomer lights the first Paschal fire. It's not somebody whose name we know. What I would say is a hint as to who they may be is found in references to the career of Palladius. So, you know, Palladius, I don't know, will this be coming up in your Patrick podcast? So
I don't know,
know you don't want to go too much into this, but just to give a little bit.
This is all part of like understanding that.
So just to give a bit just to give a bit of an explanation. So there's this chronicler and ghost writer, a man named Prosper of Aquitaine, and he's somebody who's involved in a lot of controversies around the importance of grace and free will in Christianity.
Because this has all been worked out. I think this is the other thing, you know, that Ireland was part of this world, but this world, it hadn't all been like decided upon.
No, not at all. And I suppose one thing I'd sort of like to
maybe Ireland was still part of that evolving conversation.
Very much so. And one thing I suppose I'd like to emphasise a little bit later, so remind me to do so, yeah, is the extent to which Christianity coming to Ireland is part of a package of other things.
Yeah.
So it's not just Christianity itself. But yeah, okay. I suppose just to finish, because otherwise it'll end up being sort of a hanging point, just to finish with Palladius. So Prosper is absolutely obsessed with heresy.
Yeah.
And eventually he finally, I suppose to his delight, ends up being a confidant of Leo the Great, an important pope, and his ghostwriter.
Yeah.
But he gives two references to Ireland. One is in his chronicle, which effectively is obsessed with heresy.
Mm.
And he refers to Palladius being sent as a bishop, first bishop to the Irish believing in Christ. From a previous entry, we know that Palladius is somebody who is also involved in this controversy. And it's more than likely what we're looking at is that as part of this sort of change in the Western Roman Empire, the papacy is beginning to flex itself a little bit. It's trying to create churches which are loyal to Rome out of what is effectively a sea of different Christianities. And Peter Brown has a great phrase for this, where he says we can't really talk about Christendom. We're talking about micro-Christianities.
Okay.
And so there's lots of variation, local variation. Yeah. So, you know, when people talk about Celtic Christianity, which we just usually say no, please.
Yeah.
But in a sense, the idea...
I'd love for someone to describe what Celtic Christianity is.
Well, exactly. The idea that this it's somehow unique, but, you know, that uniqueness is absolutely common.
Yeah.
Because all of these expressions of Christianity are brought about by the meeting of what has become a very Romanized church at this stage with various local cultures. Of course, there's differences between them in various ways. But for the church in Rome, as long as it's doctrinally coherent and Rome is seen as the head of the church, that's fine, basically.
Yeah.
So I suppose the essence of this is that in 431, there are Irish Christian communities who are significant enough for the papacy to take notice of this.
Yeah.
And later on in another document, which you will not be surprised to hear, is also obsessed with heresy. This is Prosper giving out about Cassian's institutes. And Cassian, he's a writer around monastic practice, actually very, very popular in Ireland as it happens, and basically saying Cassian is a heretic. He says, by the by, he gives a little encomium of Pope Celestine. And says, you know, Pope Celestine made the barbarian island Christian. But that could be just Prosper bigging things up. I mean, you have to remember with Prosper that there's so much bias in what he's saying and what he's recording. But there's no reason to think he made it up either. So what you're looking at is there's Christian communities there. How are they in communication with Rome? Who are they communicating with?
Yeah.
What languages are they using?
How are they communicating?
And are they politically significant?
Yeah.
So are you looking in maybe the early decades of the 5th century? Probably, I would guess on the East Coast. And interestingly enough, later associations, ecclesiastical associations with Palladius are all East Coast and they're all Leinster.
Yeah.
You know, and there's enough there, I think, to suggest there's maybe a Leinster strand of Christianity which is coming from this sort of very Roman influence, and maybe what Patrick is doing is somewhat different.
He's doing something out in the West.
He's doing something out in the West, so I think, you know, what you're seeing there is, again, Ireland is, you know, it might be a minor part of it, but it's part of that network of change and development, and also part of that story of church
and
institutionalization.
It could be used if anyone wanted to look in more, like understanding what you're doing, you know, drawing Ireland into this world.
It's absolutely,
you know, people keep on ignoring Ireland as part of
it's absolutely being drawn in. I mean, why would a pope have that interest unless it's, you know,
unless
significant enough. So you mean you clearly at that point have those communities there. Who their leaders are, we don't know. And the first people who brought Christianity to Ireland, we don't know, probably came via trade and communication, almost certainly, I would say.
So then, as I said, we'll get on to whether the church kind of, so the church is an institution, you know, and it's what is we now know as the Catholic Church. But that how it, you know, now acts is quite different to how it did in this early period. But that is what it involved, you know, so we can recognize it as the Roman Catholic Church. That's a big institution and that's an organized religion. What about religious faith, though? So cause people always ask, what did actual, you know, people believe in before Christianity? We have a lot of evidence about Christianity in early Ireland. We know what form it took. We have a lot of texts. So the term, you know, people keep on using terms like paganism, right? Okay. And again, how do you define, like, there is no such thing as paganism.
No.
As in, it implies that there is a definition of some unified system of beliefs, which,
yeah,
we don't
it's
have.
Paganism is essentially a construct.
Yeah, is a yeah. So people tie in. So if we don't, do we know what any kind of faith people might have had before Christianity in Ireland? Do we have any evidence?
Well, we've very little evidence, yeah. But I mean, there's certainly some pointers. I mean, I suppose the first thing I would say is, if you look at the idea of paganism, we can't use that as our starting point. I mean, the term paganism, as you know, you know, comes from the idea of people who live in the countryside. It's effectively saying country bumpkins, who don't have the sophistication of the city dwellers, who know the true religion. I mean, it's an abusive term. It's used by Christians pejoratively to create a sort of an anti-church and to say there's this singular enemy which has been inspired by demons, and that part of their mission is to, you know, destroy this demonic enemy. And I mean, there's a great article by James Palmer for people who are interested in how that term paganism is used and deployed in the early Middle Ages. And it's one I actually found quite useful when I was looking at the Irish material. I think much more useful is if we're thinking about beliefs, which is a term I tend to prefer to the use of the term religion, which has, I think, a somewhat different meaning. But if you look at pre-Christian beliefs, let's say if we take an example of ones that are known. So if we look at the myriad of classical cults. So you've got, say, your cult of the emperor, you've got the cult of the various gods, but you also have a lot of localized cults. There's a huge variety in the Roman Empire. But one thing which is interesting about them, and there's some great studies on this, is if you look at the way pre-Christian beliefs are organized in the Roman Empire, they very often don't have professional priesthoods. So in some cases, somebody may become a priest or a priestess, but for only part of their life. The Vestal Virgins are a very good example. They're not perpetual virgins at all. So it's something that somebody might do in one part of their life, and they might do something else in another part of their life. They normally are not as institutionally organized as Christianity is, because Christianity effectively models itself on the secular organization of the Roman Empire. So they're not like that at all. Yeah. They're not like a mini state within a state. They have a lot of variety. They don't usually require huge levels of literacy. Yeah. They don't normally have very complicated belief systems. Yeah. It doesn't mean that their belief systems aren't sophisticated. They're just not the type that we see maybe in Abrahamic religions. Yeah. And they don't have a big sacred text. Yeah. And they're not expensive.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, they're a very different, to mix my metaphors, kettle of fish.
And what do you say to people who say, you know, well, the place names that use, you know, the names of the rivers in Ireland, or, you know, like the Boyne and the Shannon and all these things, that shows us some evidence of, you know, like pre-Christian or non-Christian belief system?
Well, what I'd sort of say is I sort of divide it almost into two, I suppose. One is that, I mean, because I'm just not comfortable with using the term pagan.
Yeah.
I tend to prefer to say sort of native beliefs or native systems. Yeah. Is that even though I know the term native now can have unfortunate connotations.
So no to pagan, no to Celtic, no to native.
So there'll have to be something new. But anyway, now we've got that out of the way. So I think there's sort of two things. There's lots of aspects, again, going back to what we said earlier, there's lots of aspects of pre-Christian society which is not actually about beliefs. It's just about how you run your life.
Yeah.
And these aspects, most of them, continue on. And the Irish themselves acknowledge it.
Yeah.
And they give us a clue. They have that whole story of Patrick setting up a sort of a commission to see what can be kept.
Yeah,
and he basically says, all the things that aren't against God, just keep on doing them.
Yeah.
So an awful lot of aspects of that society you know, continues on as it was. And obviously it develops from then as well. You can also see it, though. There's hints given to us by the 7th century writers because they are thinking about this a lot. And one of the ones that's most striking is their reference to wells. Wells and Springs. Mm. And this is maybe not all that surprising. It's something we see elsewhere as well.
Yeah.
Wells and springs are often the focus of types of devotion.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tyrachon in particular, one of the writers about Patrick, is very straight up.
Yeah.
It's just like, there used to be a demon worshipped here. Now it's dedicated to St. Patrick. And it's very reminiscent of what we see in Gregory's letter to Augustine in Bede's Ecclesiastical History.
Yeah.
So talking about the conversion of the English. And Gregory, who's the very famous early medieval pope, says, well, you know, if there's a place that's important to them, put an altar there, dedicate it to a saint. If there's something that they're doing which is important to them sort of ritually, obviously he doesn't use the word ritual, you know, again, dedicated to a saint. So you can sort of see that areas like Kropatrick is probably another example of this.
But I think topography, it's so obvious.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like, so I think you can look and see that if you look at that landscape and if you look at your place names and so on, I think you can see the sort of underlay overlay going on. And it's a very effective strategy.
Yeah.
I mean, when you later see Gregory recommending it for the conversion of the English, it's something that is knowingly being done.
It doesn't mean, though, that the Christian Bridget just supplanted pre-Christian
goddess. No, but that's sort of
that's just
sort of crazy because
going too far.
It's also you're just not going to have a really important keystone stained in the early medieval period.
Yeah.
Being
collective
a pagan
amnesia.
Goddess.
So then two questions, and unfortunately then we'll have to wrap it up. Did the church, like, what impact did the church, you know, did it radically change society, how people lived? And Druids.
Okay.
Exclamation point.
Or maybe two exclamation mark. With the church, you know, the answer is going to be one of those boring it did and it didn't.
Yeah.
So, okay, as an institution, absolutely, it becomes a really powerful institution. And one of the things that you can see, you know, from the point where the early Irish customary law comes to be written down, is that the church is pretty seamlessly inserted into that.
Those power structures. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a new power structure, but it's also one that joins various other aspects of that society together. So I sort of like to think of it not so much as that they create that system, which clearly is not of Christian origin, whatever people might say. But what they do is they frame it.
Yeah.
And they not only frame it, they insert themselves into that framework in a really powerful way.
Yeah.
So the church is really important.
And it probably went on in that period that we don't have the resources for.
Absolutely.
The
sixth century has to be the key period.
Yeah.
It has to be the key
period.
We
just don't know how that evolved because it comes down to us as very kind of firmly established.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, it sort of has to be that for what we get in the seventh century, because in order for the church to be in that position.
Good point.
You also need to have conversions of the elite happening as well. So it's sort of that period. I mean, at what point do Christians become a majority over various non-Christians? And I mean, that's a difficult point to answer. You know, it could be as early as the end of the fifth century, or it could be as late as the middle of the sixth century. It's something I've been thinking a bit about. I haven't come to any conclusions yet. I may never come to a conclusion. But so that's a really interesting period. So church is institutionally very important. A second thing it does, I wouldn't call this transformative so much as, well, it is, but one of the points I think is really important to try and, I suppose, get across is that Christianization is part of a whole series of correlating factors. So in a sense, those contacts between Ireland and the Roman Empire over many, many centuries had already begun to change or influence Irish societies in different ways. And one of the reasons I think Christianity gains a level of success is because it's meaningful to people, because it's already Romanized. So the Christianity the Irish are getting,
they're identifying it as part,
it's
of
part
the
of that package. It's part of that package of sort of Roman, sort of Romanization. Obviously, they wouldn't have used that term, but it's got an understandability and an intelligibility to them because that Roman cultural context is already intelligible to them. So it's part of that. Now, part of that is the introduction, I suppose, of an education system around around Christian scripture. Now, I would argue that literacy doesn't come with the church necessarily. I think if you look at the invention of Ogham, it probably has to be invented in the 4th century and has almost certainly nothing to do with Christianity at the very beginning, though it is very happily used by Christians, just the way they use the Latin alphabet, which wasn't invented by Christians either.
Yeah.
You know, so they use what tools that they have.
Yeah.
So it introduces a system of pedagogy.
Yeah.
And it's from that system of pedagogy that we get the texts that we have.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there's other elements such as the education of the poets that aligns with it to some extent as well.
Does this bring us into Druids?
Which brings us into Druids, I suppose, in a natural. I don't think they're the same. I mean, my argument, which I've sort of put out there very tentatively, is that the Philid are effectively a new literate class created in late antiquity, probably associated with Ogham.
Yeah.
And that the Philid are also a group who make early and creative links with the ecclesiastical institutions.
Yeah.
And this is then reflected actually in those lives of Patrick as well, where the Philid are basically, they're there as the allies of the church.
Yeah.
So I think they're a different case. So the Druids, obviously, this is an area of controversy. Because when
we kind of implied a little bit, you know, that Druids didn't, you know, ever exist, but they are referred to in the sources. And I think, to me,
and they're in the law tracts as well.
Yeah,
you know?
They're in the law tracts. So. But what's interesting is, again, it's about whether people see them now as religious entities.
Absolutely.
Whereas actually, when you just look at the earliest sources, I'm like, at what point are they seen as,
are they
classified as religious practitioners?
Are they religious? I mean, I suppose the different distinction I would make is they may be religious practitioners, might be part of their role, but are they really religious professionals?
Yes.
In effect, one of the things that makes Christianity so different from those classical religions I mentioned and makes it so powerful is it's got a coherent body of religious professionals.
Yeah.
And through these systems of pedagogy.
Yeah. So Druids then wouldn't have been necessarily.
No, I mean, I think, I mean,
not that we have any.
No, I mean, I think, for what I think it's, like. I think it's reductionist to say they didn't exist. The term Druid, it's a native Irish term. Yeah. It's not borrowed from reading Caesar's Gallic Wars.
Yeah.
I think what the problem is what the Druids have become, maybe.
Yeah.
So, in effect, when people think about Druids, in their head, what you're getting is a sort of a mashup of Caesar's Wickerman sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then Druids, Murucu's Druids.
Or for my generation, it's Asterix and all
Yeah, absolutely.
What's the, it's not Getafix.
It's Getafix.
So that's what a Druid is for me.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Druids, the idea that the Druids are somehow this priesthood who are standing up against Christianity, it just doesn't seem very likely to me.
But it ties into what you were saying about how the term, you know, pagani or pagan or whatever, was just a pejorative term used by Christians to other the people who didn't
absolutely
have the exact
same and that's what's happening in some of the sort of early Christian writers.
Yeah.
So, for example, Murucu has the Druids going around with books, for example, and effectively having a hierarchy and being an anti-church. It's highly, highly unlikely Druids of that type ever existed.
Yeah.
They're much more likely to have been local holy men. Another model, which I think is interesting, is in the Vita Prima of Bridget, where that's the way the Druids are portrayed. So there isn't any hostility between Bridget and her Druid foster father, for example. And he's somebody who converts to Christianity. And he's sort of a wise man. That's how he's presented.
And the problem that we have, and this is where all these debates come from, the problem that we have is that these surviving written sources are all deeply Christian texts that are referencing them, so we can't treat them as reliable.
We can't treat them as reliable,
but it doesn't mean that Druids didn't exist. It just means that
absolutely. And it's like when you have, say, one side of a conversation. But I mean, it's worth saying as well that if you look at that, the literature on the Druids is quite various. So sometimes Druids are presented positively, sometimes negatively. You know what, they're very handy for the authors, early Irish authors, because a Druid can be whatever you want a Druid to be.
And then we're using the word Druid, but like they do have different terms depending on whether the texts are in Latin or Irish, which we didn't get onto, but we will in a future episode with
Professor
Stifter about the
That's absolutely fascinating.
It is an important part that we didn't get time, and we did agree beforehand with Elva to, obviously she has her book anyway on literacy and identity, and she has other publications, but we agreed we'd focus on just these couple of topics. But something that is tied into that, into this conversation, is Irish, old Irish and Latin, and about kind of
the, yeah, it's absolutely fascinating that they, the term that they use, magus, because it is also a term with a complicated history, because it can be your three,
I know,
magi, your wise men, or it can be Simon Magus,
and then I don't like to say
evil anti-apostle.
So. But I also have a problem then with translating that in English as magician, because you just think Harry Potter. Again, it depends on the, if you're in 2024 or if you're in 1950, as in the how we translate terms into our own modern language, and that may not be English.
I suppose like our best German guide is the vernacular, vernacular lives, and in the vernacular lives there are three.
Okay. Thank you so much, Elva. That was brilliant. I think you've painted a really clear picture of, you know, kind of as much as we can, given the nature of the sources, of that time period in Ireland, which we've had difficulty, I think, as a nation in classifying it and understanding it. And there's clearly a lot more work to be done on that. So thank you for kind of for being our guide today into all of that. Elva actually is another person who's going to be speaking at the Bridget's World Conference in September. We were just saying she's hopefully going to talk about the Abbesses of Kildare after Bridget, but we won't hold her to that. It's only February. That's September 13th to 15th. So thank you again, Elva, for being a guest on the podcast.
And thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying the podcast episodes. If you want to contact us, you can get onto us, email medievalirishhistory@gmail.com. You can follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Early Irish Pod. Wherever you get your podcasts, if you could please do the usual like and subscribe, but also rate and review, as that will help us to reach more listeners. And we will be back again in 2 weeks' time. Bye.